open a public hearing on Senate Bill 525 and invite to the podium Senator George and Representative Brown and whomever else they'd have up with them. Yes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is State Senator Gary George, District 12, and we're pleased to bring you a bill that may look somewhat similar to one that was passed, I believe, out of this committee and off the floor of the Senate this last week, which was Senate Bill 10, I believe. What we're doing here, though, is we're saying to military personnel that were stationed in the states that they have the same opportunity for in-state tuition as the military personnel that was stationed abroad. We have, as has already been commented on by some of the members, the piece that we provided for you. And if you'll remember, in last session, House Bill 2177 was passed to allow the military personnel serving overseas the right to receive in-state tuition if they filed an Oregon income tax. What this does is says that anyone who is in service to their country, who in fact would meet those qualifications, would in fact have an opportunity for the same basis of consideration for the tuition. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alan Brown. He's actually, Alan is Alan's constituent because of redistricting now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 525, and I would encourage its passage. In 1998, Chad Ryan was attending college and living with his parents in Oklahoma prior to entering the military. He enlisted in the U.S. Air Force in 1998. In 1999, while Chad was in the military, his parents relocated to Oregon. Shortly thereafter, he changed his legal residence to Oregon and began paying Oregon income tax. He knew that he would live in Oregon with his parents once he was discharged from the military service. In 2002, after completing 5 years of service and receiving an honorable discharge, Chad Ryan moved from Missouri, where he was assigned, to Yahats, Oregon, to reside with his parents, as he had planned to do since 1999. Chad applied to the Oregon State University and was accepted, but informed that he would have to pay out-of-state tuition because he did not reside in Oregon prior to entering the military. Even though he stated Oregon was his home state in 1999, and paid taxes as an Oregon resident for over 2.5 years. After several denial appeals to the Oregon University System Institutional Residency Committee, Mr. James Arnold was chair, the residency committee stated that Chad Ryan was not eligible for an in-state tuition because he did not meet the basic resident requirements. When his appeals were denied, Chad went to Missouri and to Oklahoma only to find out that he was not a resident in either of those states because he had listed Oregon as his home state and paid Oregon taxes. Chad Ryan was a man without a state after he had served his country for 5 years. Senate Bill 525 will create a provision to include veterans who are serving in a foreign country or another state as Oregon residents if they pay Oregon income tax for 12 consecutive months prior to their discharge from for higher education purposes. And I would encourage you to pass the bill. Thank you.
Questions?
I'm working on it.
Okay, let's hear some more testimony than
that. For the record, Senator Starr and members of the committee, my name is Mark Bigger from Senator George's staff, and I just wanted to bring up a few issues that might come out in either later testimony or might be floating around your minds. First of all, we have an amendment in, and that's really up to the committee on whether they want to pursue that or not. The bill as is only addresses or tuition at Oregon and Oregon State. It's for the, but the amendment would address community colleges as well as in-state fees for hunting and fishing. And we, when we originally drafted the bill, wanted to make it as narrow as possible just to fit our particular situation. That's how we drafted it. But if the committee feels like it would be a good idea to just be consistent along all fronts and wants to move that amendment through, we're very comfortable with that as well. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair. Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just reading, and I'm sure Grattan's going to test. I don't know if Grattan's here. In the letter, you guys have seen the March 24th letter that he sent to the committee. So the only concern I would have, and I don't know if the Dash 1 amendments take this into account, would be that, well, I'm just going to paraphrase. It's in here somewhere. That this, their objection is this would grant in-state residency status basically to any member of the Army personnel anywhere. And to me, we would need to tighten that up so we're not just giving such a broad, and perhaps Dash wants to do that.
Let me rephrase the question, and maybe you can answer both. If a individual has never lived in, never worked in, as pointed out in Grattan's letter, argument, I think, that how would they, in fact, be required to file for 12 months of Oregon tax?
Chairman Starr, I think that when Chad was in the military, he must have indicated some way that his state of residency was Oregon, and he did sign up and pay Oregon income tax for 2.5 years while he was in the military.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. When you're on active duty, you select your home or record, and that is your choice. And you can select any state in the Union or any territory as your home of record. And once you do that, then you can fall under those state rules, as indicated in this situation. This young man chose Oregon as home or record. Therefore, he had to file an Oregon income tax, because that was his home or record. Because that's where his parents moved to. He could have just as easily chosen his home or record as any other state or any other town or place in Oregon without his parents being here. It's his choice. And when that happens, then he becomes a member, from the military standpoint, he is a resident of that state, he pays taxes in that state, and complies with their local rules concerning military members. So to answer Senator Deckard's question, probably, and you could tighten it up, you can do anything you want, but you've already got a 12-month requirement in here that the individual has to be 12 months as a resident of the state of Oregon paying taxes to the state of Oregon. So therefore, you've already narrowed it down so you can't just 450,000 people decide they want to come to Oregon and go to school, which I doubt would happen based on the tuition rates anyway. But the point is that they have to make a commitment to Oregon at some point in their term of service while on active duty. And if they haven't done it for 12 months, then they don't fall underneath this the way I read it.
Yeah. May I ask a...
Yes.
Okay. The question is, the normal residency requirement for a student who moves to Oregon is 12 months, as I understand it. Is that your
understanding? I can't answer that.
Okay. So I guess maybe it isn't a question, but I think that this meets that requirement by paying taxes for 12 months. And I don't have a problem with that. I guess that was one of the clarifications I wanted, is that it is a regular... The 12-month residence requirement is met by paying Oregon taxes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, that's correct. And if you maybe recall last session, we actually had another bill that dealt strictly with the National Guard on the same question. We actually had National Guard members who worked for the governor, were working in Oregon paying taxes and in the National Guard, but yet they couldn't get in-state tuition because they didn't meet Department of Education or Higher Ed's requirement for that. We changed that. This legislature changed that last session, and said, that's ridiculous. If you're working for the commander-in-chief of the state of Oregon, then you ought to at least get in-state tuition. So we changed that a year or 2 years ago.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, you know, if you think about House Bill 2177 from last session, and you think about what we're doing is we're saying it doesn't make any difference because no matter what, whether you're abroad or whether you're working in support or whatever inside of the United States, you should be considered the same relative to coming back to your state where you appropriately paid the income tax for at least 12 months prior to being discharged to be able to come back and have in-state tuition. And that was, to me, the issue of this was just a matter of fairness. We should have done it a long time ago for the folks that came across that problem, and now we should do it for the remaining loophole, which is the fact that someone was, in fact, stationed in the United States.
Or anywhere else.
Or anywhere, yeah.
Any further questions? Colonel Caldwell, have you further?
Mr. Chairman, we support the bill.
You support the bill?
Yes, sir.
Very good. Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
We have one other witness. Jim Ludwig.
Thank you, Senator Starr. My name is Jim Ludwig. I live at 7500 Southwest Leibold Road in McMinnville, Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of this bill. When I came to the legislature today, I had no intention of testifying, but when I spoke to Representative Brown's aide, Lindsay, and she mentioned that this bill was going to have a hearing today, I said I wanted to testify in favor of it. The reason I'm in favor of this bill is I think it's the very least that we can do in a way of saying thank you to people who put their lives on the line and move and put their lives on the line in the sense of their very existence and also in the sense of where all the things they do for us in protecting our liberties. Under any time, this would be a good idea. Particularly now, I think this would be a great way of saying thank you to these people. You know, I'm proud when I read about somebody from Oregon being in the military, but I really don't view military people as from states. I view them as an American, period. And I think they should be granted all the privileges that every citizen has in the United States, and in particular in Oregon. And I, from that viewpoint, I think they should get in-state tuition. Following World War II, one of the most important things that Congress did is pass the GI Bill. The GI Bill, some people say, made the middle class in the United States by letting veterans enter into schools that they never could have prior to the war. And I think our country is far better for it. And for all those reasons, I urge that you pass Senate Bill 525. Thank you.
Thank you very much. On the record, in 1958, I was discharged from the U.S. Army and made application to attend the University of California from Idaho as a veteran, as a married veteran with a child, indicated to those folks I was moving to California to go to school and I'd like to be considered for in-state residency tuition, and I was granted such in 1958. That's 45 years ago. I think we're a little slow in getting our thing right, but I would hope that we can move this bill. I think that it would be my druthers to move it on and ask to take the referral from Ways and Means off so that it can perhaps catch up to Senate Bill 10 and be considered together when it gets to Ways and Means. With that, I would ask, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 525. Would encourage a motion.
You want to go to Ways and Means?
No, I won't.
No.
You want to rescind the referral?
I want to rescind the referral and ask the President to send it on to the House before we'd send Senate Bill 10.
Mm-hmm. The only question, Mr. Chair, that I have, maybe Jan could answer this. So this just narrowly defines it's the 1 year. So if I paid income taxes, I'm a member of the Army and I paid income taxes, I could be stationed in Georgia or wherever, and I paid income taxes for 1 year, and I've declared Oregon as my residency. This bill says then I get in-state tuition.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, The bill says that they have to file a return within 12 months of leaving active duty. So I'm trying to think of a real-life scenario. So if they left active duty in June, they would have a year following that to file an income tax return in order to be considered resident. I'm looking to the audience to see if I'm understanding this correctly.
Line 13-14.
So, no later than 12 months before.
Before
leaving service.
So if they left in June, they would have had to have filed an Oregon return the prior June.
June.
That year.
So they're thinking, ahead, Mr. Chair. They would file, say in June, they were going to enroll in September at one of our institutions. So they would, the year before that June or whenever, would file in Oregon, though perhaps they haven't been to Oregon, most likely they have.
Right. But they've declared
Oregon as their home.
Yeah. In order to file an Oregon tax, I think that's required.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is just meeting the one-year Oregon residency requirement. I mean, to me, it's a very simple thing. You're meeting the requirement, not by actually physically being here, but by filing for declaring your Oregon residency by your income tax return. And that, now, the difference between a serviceman and any other person is that we are making a concession to the serviceman. I mean, that's something that we're doing because we think it's important to do, but we are still maintaining our one-year requirement. I think that's, as far as I'm concerned, that sounds fair and reasonable.
We did it for veterans who are serving outside of the United States 2 years ago. Now we're just doing it for
inside.
Yeah.
Let's go.
So, do you want to make a referral?
So we need to rescind the referral.
Rescind the referral. I move we rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
And pass the bill to
the floor. Pass the bill to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Marsette has moved that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means and move Senate Bill 525 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
So we do not want to consider the amendments, is that?
We're not going to consider the amendments. We're just going to leave it uncluttered. And
Okay. I don't want to undo the motion yet, but why do we not make all institutions, including community colleges, as available? I mean, that to me would make sense. And so I guess I would back out of my motion and ask that we do an amendment that would include the university system and the community college system. I think it's too narrow dealing with just Oregon.
Okay.
Now, we don't have those amendments.
You've got the community colleges and fishing license.
Well, okay. I think the university system should be included. And in some ways, to make it parallel to Senate Bill 10 that we passed out, I mean, that we're making all of those available to people who qualify.
Senator Caldwell.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just draw your attention to page 2 of the bill. On the first and second line, it talks about any institution that is under the control of the State Board of Higher Education.
Okay.
To me, that would include all of the regional universities as well as the two major universities for the state, I would think. Put in?
I would think so.
Yeah. So I think you've got that.
Okay. I guess I was going by the...
Yeah. So I think you've got what you want.
Okay. So the amendment then would put the community colleges into the bill. Okay. So I would move the dash one amendments.
Not the... The dash ones give you the community and fishing licenses.
I would move the dash one amendments.
Business license is not a real big deal. I think that would be...
Okay.
All right.
It's not a big deal. They're going to have to still...
Senator Morissette has withdrawn his original motion, has moved dash one amendments to Senate Bill 525. Any objection?
Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Morissette.
Okay, I would move Senate Bill. Are we still on 372?
525.
Oh, I've got my wrong thing open here. Okay, I would move Senate Bill 525 as amended with the withdrawal from Ways and Means Committee. That's included in my amendment to floor of the House with the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette has moved Senate Bill 525 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, asking for rescinding of referral to Ways and Means. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Aye.
Vice Chair
Dicker?
Aye.
Chair Starr?
Aye. I have received the necessary votes. Senate Bill 525 is referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation, provided the Senate President rescinds referral to Ways and Means.
Senator George Carrier?
Senator George is the carrier.
Thank you very much. Very good.
They are.
Now we're on Senate Bill 372.
So that got pulled, Senator Morissette.
What?
372 was pulled off the agenda.
Okay, I didn't want to hear that one anyway. Oh, the new agenda. Very good. Oh, good. That's why the room isn't full of cheap. Okay.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 644. And I invite Senator Deckert and Bratton Perrins to come forward and talk to us about Senate Bill 644. Senator Decker.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of this very distinguished committee. I'm going to be really blunt and right to the point. I got interested in this idea. I was a member of the WICHE Commission, and we had our meeting in Denver, and the governor of Colorado came and spoke about a program that he was introducing. And by way of introduction, he introduced, said, I'm the probably the most conservative governor in the United States, and I want to tell you about my plan or my ideas for higher education. And for me, I thought, well, gosh, this is not going to be an idea that I probably would be entirely receptive to. But he walked through the plan, and I had a high degree of skepticism throughout as he walked through the plan that they're introducing in Colorado right now, Governor Owens is. And I found myself very intrigued and continued to be intrigued by the idea that he had put into motion. Here's the main components of Senate Bill 644. It addresses a question critical to higher education in Oregon, and that is how do we ensure that high school students pursue higher education and what incentives will help boost their participation. The bill utilizes existing funds but reallocates them to students, creating education saving accounts to encourage their enrollments at an institute, in-state institute of higher learning in the state. It is a creative way to reach out to these students who wouldn't normally see higher education as an option. And as we move into an economy that is more and more dependent on a degree from a higher institution of higher learning, I think this idea, which is taking heart in Colorado, will be one that other states, I believe, will look very hard at. The idea is, as I said, I think it's pretty straightforward and simple. It allows the money, rather than going to the institutions, it puts the money in the hands of the students. It allows them to be consumers and creates accounts for that student. And one of the things, especially especially considering the cuts we have made and the situation that we find ourselves in regarding the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which I think all of us know, Oregon for low-income students does not stack very high, and I think the latest report card gave us either a D or an F in this arena of how do we fund need-based aid to those low-income students throughout Oregon that have the merit. They can get into an institution, but the price tag simply keeps them out. And this program, I believe, is one that is very, very effective at addressing those students because it tells students that beginning in early on in their high school career, that the state of Oregon, which we do, it's embedded in our aid to our universities, that we have some help for you. But this does it in the way, first of a letter, which goes out to that student and says, and this is a student, we can put ourselves in her or his shoes, that really has never heard from the state that they have money available to them to go to college. And then it puts the money in an account in that student's name where that student gets to then access their own funds to go to one of the institutions of higher learning in that state. To me, it is beautiful in its simplicity, but it also is beautiful in terms of the encouragement it gives to that student to, for the first time in their lives, there is money in the account for them to go to college, and I think it creates the right type of entrepreneurialism in that student, but also the desire. So I offer this bill up to the committee. It would be a huge change the way we finance higher education. So I'm not sure it's something that we do this session, though I'm continue to be at least very, very intrigued with the notion because I think and met with the chancellor's office several times on this. I think it's an idea that really would be one that would change the way we finance higher education dramatically, but in some ways, I think in a consumer-driven approach, it fits well with what we've been doing with Senate Bill 437, which we have in front of this committee, which encourages entrepreneurialism at our institutions. This does it in a very important way by creating consumers out there and letting students really be the shoppers with money attached to them rather than our institutions. With that, I will
Senator Perioli?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this proposal sounds vaguely familiar. And I'm wondering how, if you applied this to K-12 students, this would be different than a voucher program.
Yeah, I mean, Chair Starr, Senator Farrelly, in some ways, the language around it, although I think the circumstances on higher ed and K-12 are vastly different.
I agree.
For a number of reasons.
I'm just looking at mechanisms. So if I understand the proposal, instead of the general fund making an appropriation to institutions, the general fund would apportion the dollars among the high school student savings accounts. And so the question is, you know, some students are non-matriculant by choice. So would they sit on their account, or would their account only be good until they registered for the fall of the next year, and then the dollars go back to the general fund? I mean, how does that work?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
I think they have, Jenny from my office could answer this if she would like to come up. I think they have 2 years. Yeah, it's 2 years to go. And so the program that they've developed in Colorado, which there is no pride of authorship at all in this because we're just basically lifting the Colorado system, they give them 2 years.
Okay. And, to do it. And so the institutions essentially, for the 30% in some communities and 70% of other communities of children that don't go to a community college or an institution of higher learning, the agencies would have to eat that for 2 years, or the institutions would be deprived of that income for 2 years in a gross sense, if that were the case.
Well, you know, Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, in some ways this bill is designed at those communities.
I agree. I mean, I can see the benefit of this because the problem that many people find, Mr. Chairman, if I could continue. Thank you. You're right in identifying the problem as economic. I utterly agree with that. I think that many more students would go to institutions of higher learning if they had a mechanism to pay for it. Mm-hmm. So you're right about that part, no question. There still are some students that simply are not going to be
higher institution bound for education. They may go to trade schools. They may go to the School of Hard Knocks. You know, they may get an education in an apprenticeship program, which would be not be considered an institution of higher learning and not something that usually is eligible for general fund distributions. And I just wondered if the institutions have a mechanism for dealing with that two-year. I mean, eventually every kid that goes to an institution of higher learning is going to pay an institution of higher learning to go there. Either they're going to earn a scholarship or they're going to pay their way by working or they're going to use some distribution of funding. So the schools are going to get the amount of money. They're just going to have a cash flow problem related to where this money is stuck in bank accounts somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I know that there's a trigger and the student has to be serious about it. Attending, obviously, admitted is the first. Admitted into one of the colleges or universities. You're right in terms of there could be, I could see a scenario where you would have that two-year lag time where admitted and then the clock's on.
Right.
And the student, for probably a variety of reasons that I would assume many would come into play, might matriculate in and out, and you certainly could have that lag time. I do want to stress the point, though, that your question brought up in terms of the first one, because I really think the best features of this program really are designed at those students that the opportunity grant is after.
Yeah.
It is those students that we know every time we raise tuition in the state that we lose because we have such low funding of our opportunity grant compared to other states. And this is, I think, the biggest quiver we have in our arrow to really go at those students in a way that is creative to say that hopefully we do the right thing on the opportunity grant this session. And that's I'll spend a good deal of my time on that. But the other, I think we should put this into the idea basket that we have out there into the future of how do you really get at these students, because I think it's those low-income students that this program really is designed for. The research is pretty clear that those whose parents have the means, they're not, the financial question is not the primary barrier that they're facing in terms of going on to college, but it's for a lot of our communities, we know it that we lose them every time we raise tuition. Who leaves is those students from low-income communities.
Sure. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, the only other observation I'll make, the concept's intriguing to me, the only other observation I'll make is to remind the Education Committee, the legislature created a scholarship program for foster children, foster care kids, in the last legislative session, didn't fund it. And that was that long-term foster care kids who have virtually no access to sources of funding from family, in many cases. Sometimes they do, but in many cases they do not. We created a scholarship fund for those kids. We didn't fund it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a series of promises that are made yet not fulfilled. And I'm wondering if those are the ones that we ought to work on while we consider some new concepts like this one.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Morset.
Okay, I'll be anxious to hear Bratton's testimony, but I guess I notice in on page 3 of the bill, it's 6 of section 5, the monies received from appropriations, donations, and grants will be credited to the fund. So the monies can come from a variety of places. But if it goes into an account when a freshman in high school, there are a lot of, first of all, qualification for entry into the higher ed system is beyond what some people will achieve, and if the grading system means anything, it means that there's a large percentage of people out of high school who will not be eligible to go to four-year institution, and they may choose to go to a junior college or a junior college, a community college first, and then transfer and so on. It just seems confusing to me that you could start. Okay, now on the other hand, there are students who know they want to go to a four-year school. When they're freshmen, they're building their resume, they're looking for scholarships, they're headed in that direction, and I can mm-hmm. see a great deal of benefit for these students, but it seems to me it's a fairly narrow group. Is it a fairly narrow group? Am I off base by talking about a lot of people not qualifying and so on?
Chair Starr, Senator Morset, my feeling is that, and we should really distinguish admission is the triggering factor for your account. Before that, it is, I think Grattan has ably put it, it's somewhat of a marketing program because it is allowing these students in the form of correspondence from either the chancellor's office or the state to say, young Johnny or Judy, mm-hmm. we've got a place for you, and we also have, instead of today, we basically embed that subsidy. This would take that subsidy out of the embedded process and put it in the form of, we have $4,700 or whatever the amount is available for you, and then your junior year. Obviously, that's going to grow as you get closer to making that decision of if you choose to access it or not. I would agree, the vast majority probably would not access it, but it is for those who, and I think it's more than a marketing because there's actually dollars that back it up upon a mission, upon graduation mission, but it's really directed at those students who would choose to access their education savings account.
Okay. May I?
Yes.
Well, I notice on page 2 in lines 11, it starts, the commission shall reduce the individual education savings account to the student based on the reimbursement amount paid for a voucher. It is a voucher, and then a qualified student may receive up to, and then that will fill in the blanks. And then line 18, each school year, the commission shall notify high school freshmen, all high school freshmen, about the availability of an individual savings account upon graduation. So each person will be notified saying that there will be money set aside for them if they qualify.
Precisely.
At some point. Okay, now I'm sure the amount of money that will be set aside is based on the actuarial numbers of how many people are likely to apply. You have to take that into consideration because you can't put money aside for every single freshman. And is that correct?
I think the reason, Senator Starr, Chair Starr, Senator Merced, I think the reason you see blanks is that a great deal of work would have to... the concept for me is very interesting. A great deal of work would have to be done. One big factor that we would have to consider is different students cost different amount. An engineering student costs different than a history student, a history major. And so all of those factors have to be taken account. I think Colorado has handled these questions. Once you get the commitment in terms of the policy, then at working out how the dollars flow to ensure you have a sustainable system, I actually don't think that's too problematic at all. I think the bigger hurdle and the bigger question that this committee would have is this a policy direction that we would be interested in? I'm interested in it. It's a big change from the way we finance higher education, and so these big decisions usually need to take time because they're big decisions. I know the governor of Colorado spent an interim working on getting it ready for this legislative session that they're in right now, moving the legislation. So I think, and I would put it out to the committee, if this committee is very interested in, we think, judging our colleagues, that this would have a widespread acceptance and interest, then we probably should move forward, either an interim study or an interim task force to continue to work on this or to keep it alive. If the committee thinks, interesting idea, but not one that we want to go with, then we've got about 5 or 10 minutes left on the clicker, and then we can move on.
Further questions? Thank you. Grattan, could you respond, please?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Grattan Cairns, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System, and like Senator Deckert, the university system, the Chancellor's Office has been tracking the work of the Blue Ribbon Commission and the Colorado Commission on Higher Education. Blue Ribbon Commission of members of the commission and distinguished individuals and governors and former governors and a whole lot of other people working on this concept. This bill is far different from, much different from what has actually got turned into legislation in the Colorado House, which was just introduced, I think, yesterday. But don't want to get mired in the details of it. The university system would counsel you against using this or another mechanism like it to get to what is the root issue here. And here we agree wholeheartedly, in fact, would have a heated agreement with the senator over, and every member of this legislature and every citizen of Oregon over the issue of how do we provide effective notice and get students who believe they are not college-bound by virtue of their socioeconomic condition to internalize the value of the investment that the state, through its appropriation to its public post-secondary institutions, through its appropriation to the Opportunity Grant, through federal tax appropriations, through Pell Grants, through federal and other state support and campus support for work-study programs, to sum those things up and find that the taxpayers of the state and the nation are prepared to invest and invest heavily in them. And that's the root issue here, Mr. Chairman. And I believe that what we would have here is something which would cause us to, if it were implemented after it was perfected, cause us to first dismantle our resource allocation model, change to a completely different system. I don't know what that would look like. And then have to await the arrival of those who come with the voucher or the slip that says I've got something in that savings account, which then raises a whole lot of other problems. The bill in Colorado and the driving force there is to escape the taxpayer's Bill of Rights. It is supported wholeheartedly by the public post-secondary institutions there because they can see that they can escape from the terms of the taxpayer's Bill of Rights and be able to get out on their own and achieve a different status. And that's why it's being supported there. We don't have the same circumstances here in Oregon, but we have the same problem. So the university system would agree with the senator and with you and everyone else. Let's go to the problem and address that. The senator is correct. This and the Colorado plan, unless it is a true entitlement program, and you're willing to raise taxes and appropriate money to education savings accounts for everyone who qualifies, as many as come, then it's not an entitlement and it has to be limited. So either there's a limited number of people who can get one of these, or the value of it goes down as the number who qualify goes out. So it's not an entitlement. In effect, it's a coupon that says, depending on when you get there, you'll get some money based on the number of people who have one of these and who seek admission based on the appropriation of the legislature to these accounts. We would say that rather than going through that process, jump over it and say, how do we identify the students in this state by virtue of the fact that they are poor, their families are poor, there is no history of college attendance in that family, so they're not a legacy student. They are debt-averse as a class. They are overwhelmed by the price, and when they do approach us, filling out a FAFSA and get the result back, find out that the ticket inside the university system, in fact, higher education in the United States of America, is primarily through guaranteed student loans. That's when these people go away. And we do not have a good record in Oregon, in the university system, of getting these folks enrolled, retained, and graduated in relationship to those who are at the median, the fourth quintile or the top quintile. They're just not making the grade. So the question is, how do we get the marketing plan without the mechanism? And what has to stand behind that marketing plan? I believe it can be devised, but it requires a response on behalf of the people of Oregon and the governor and the legislature to appropriate to the level necessary to make that marketing plan real to the student who's reached. We could very easily devise a plan in which we went out to, let's take the lowest 100 SES census tract districts in the state of Oregon and match them to high school attendance areas. Or the lowest 200, the lowest 300, whatever the cut may be. And tell those students in those high schools in those census tracts, the state right now is willing, if you're going to go to a university system campus, will give you a need grant or an opportunity grant worth around $4,400 today for 4 years. The state will invest in your education if you enroll and persist to graduation, $5,500 a year today. And the federal government, if you qualify, will invest $4,100 or $4,200 in a Pell Grant today. Now, at that point, you're telling that student, the taxpayers of this state and this nation are prepared to invest in you through tuition, through education support and financial aid in excess of $44,000 for a four-year education. That would change perception, Mr. Chairman. That would change perception. But it needs a commitment to stand behind it. And that's what we would recommend. No offense to the senator or to the bill. It's an excellent place to start that discussion. But rather than working our way through a mechanism changing the entire landscape of post-secondary education, the entire landscape of budgeting, and all the negative response that may come out of that from people who think it may have some downside to them, instead say, we really have an obligation to these students who select themselves out. They do select themselves out. They look in the mirror. They look their mother in the mirror. They look their father in the mirror, you know, in the face, and they say, you know what? I'm going to work with you. Or I'm going to work, period, because it's not in my future. Those are the people we need to make contact with. I'd go below high school. I think we ought to go into the middle school, where students begin to work on their academic career in secondary grades. And say to the 8th grader, the 9th grader, the 10th grader, the 11th grader, those 4 years, those who qualify and are admitted will get this investment. Do you want to be one? And marry that to the Aspire program, which the commission is working on now, and which is run entirely by volunteers, to put volunteers into those high schools to coach and counsel. That, I think, we could use this bill and talk, or another bill, or an interim study, and pull the folks around and say, how do we get at that? How do we get those people we're not serving now? I'm sorry, Mr.
Chairman. I'll
stop right there.
I like both ideas, and I think that it's an encouragement. And I was going to introduce a bill, which I never did early on, to identify, to say to kids very early on, if they pass the SIM, the CAM at the first time, that they will start building toward a college scholarship. And having talked to a third grade teacher, she thought that was a great idea, that parents would be motivated to get their kids academically involved if there was something there that they could achieve as they work their way through the system. And I think that is a great idea, but I like the idea. And I think it is worth working on, and it's worth incorporating some incentives at the very early age to parents who don't have the means to send their kids, and kids who are not even thinking college because they know they can't go. This would be a great incentive. I think it's a great beginning, so I'd like to see this go somewhere.
So, Ms. Chair, here's where I disagree with Grattan, is that one point that he made, that the state would have to, once you put that education savings account out there, and obviously it's a commitment the state is making in terms of to that student, and it's a bond that we've made. My feeling, and I look at federally the discussion around Medicare or Social Security, is that once you, and I have an interest in higher ed, and it's partly because I think in the last, the last 12 months, we've again fallen in the distinction of leading the country in per capita cuts to higher ed, and I And I think we all know the story of the Oregon Opportunity Grant and the funding decisions we've made. And I see this as a way of carving out a priority for higher education, because I think once you put the money, we as the political world, as policy leaders, once we put money in the hands of that student and those families, I think it then becomes very, very difficult. And I think we should enter this knowing that. I certainly would, and I would welcome that. It becomes very, very difficult once you've allocated a check to a student to start taking money away. I think politically it's very difficult, and I think it's difficult for one good reason, is then that family has made a decision and they've made a pact with the state of Oregon that we want our children, or one of our children, has decided to go on to college in the state of Oregon. But I think then reducing that, I think it's easier to do what we have done, which is to make strategic cuts to higher education and raise tuition. I think that's a relatively, in terms of, and if you look at states across the West, the first thing that they did in terms of these budget crises nationally, it's the first place we've gone is we've raised tuition. And so I think this turns it on its head, because I think it would be far more difficult if you look at the budget climate that we've been in, and I think we should all enter this knowing that, to go and reduce those checks that we give to students. So I just offer that up as a disagreement I would have with Grant on this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we wouldn't disagree if, in fact, you were to write an entitlement plan which said that each time you ran out of money and there were another 1,000 students, you'd raise taxes or cut somebody else's budgets in order to fund that voucher. And the size of that voucher never went down, and it was a true entitlement to the very last student who was admitted, which is not the Colorado plan. And the Colorado plan is delimited by appropriation, as this one would be delimited by appropriation. But if you want to make it into a true entitlement plan, then I think you'd probably garner some interest that's not in this bill today. But I don't know that the state is prepared to turn in this into an entitlement plan, which is an open blank check on the general fund. Because you can only borrow $50,000 and run over $50,000 and not being out of balance and deficit. I think you can get just the same way, and we've had this discussion before, and I think we're on the same side in terms of the target population. I think you get a lot of bang for the buck if the parents of an eighth grader got a letter that said, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Jones, here's what the state's going to do for Judy or Johnny." And at September of each following year, just wanted to remind you. And by the way, it's still there if you get admitted. And then you have a plan that says you go to the target population and let them know. The problem with the going to everyone is you're going to hit all the people who have a 529 plan. They've got a Uniform Gift to Minors Act plan, which grandmother started 22 years ago. You've got folks who have got all the scholarships. You know, the valedictorian's got her scholarships. And what did I say? He has all the scholarships. And all the rest of it. And here comes this thing, by the way. And they say, well, duh. I knew that. That's part of my plan.
As opposed to into the mix.
Target the population. That's what we'd say.
Thank you.
Are we helping you, Mr. Chairman? Are we helping you,
sir? I think it's an important discussion, and I do think that you're both talking about the same target people. And personally, I guess I have kind of the same perspective, but I think that it's a matter of education and motivation. I had four sons. Not one of them ever questioned whether he'd go to college. It wasn't talked about. I mean, it was a given that they were going to college. And Dad told them early on, "I'm going to help you earn your way through college." Now, that was a proper kind of incentive. Now, when they graduated, or even before they graduated from high school, they were working for their dad. I started a business for the purpose of employing my sons so they could earn enough money to go to college. And they paid for 20 years of college and 13 years after we started that business. Paid cash, got no grants, didn't need it. The
three of them graduated from the university system in Oregon. And now, that's a whole lot different than what we're trying to do. But I think that if we could begin to market the value of a college education and begin to educate parents how important it is and that we do have helps for them, it'd be a lot easier to get students into college that need to be going there for getting a college education. It's really hard to motivate people who've never had anybody in the family graduate from college. Really hard. And I think that's one of the real difficulties we face. I appreciate the discussion. Anybody have any question or comments? I think we're going to just kind of let it sit there and simmer a little bit. But we're going to continue talking about how we're going to help students with student aid of various kinds and how we're going to fund higher education in Oregon. And appreciate it. This is a different and an unusual idea. I don't think we're ready for it in this climate. And that's Chair's opinion that we will not bring this back for a work session. But I do thank you for bringing it.
I'd like to make one further comment, and I think Grattan hit on the idea of starting the discussion earlier than the high school. I think that there has to be some discussion, and there has to be some incentive and some rewards, and I like that idea that money be set aside for those who qualify. And I think it's important to target. I think it's a great idea that needs to be combined.
The SPIRE program is a good complement to the whole thing. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing and adjourn the Senate Committee on Education. And I thank you all for your kind attention.